Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Please consider supporting Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. You can learn more about them at bwunited.ca. They are always looking for donations and volunteers. So please, again, support Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. Again, that website is bwunited.ca.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and I live in Wichita, Kansas. I am a Patreon supporter for Creative Control. I discovered Creative Control some years ago, I think maybe while looking for interviews with Tommy Stinson of The Replacements. And I stumbled across this conversation that Vish had with Tommy Stinson that was really insightful. Vish held his own. I think Tommy can be a little bit of a difficult interview at times. And it went really well, and it really got into some areas that I wasn't expecting. And I thought, gosh, I have to listen to more of this guy and his podcast. Yeah, sometimes I'm not necessarily a fan of the music or musicians that Vish will have on the show, but I always appreciate their creative process a little bit more. And more times than not, though, it does lead me to finding a new musical artist that I'm interested in, or to think a little bit differently about maybe some artists whose work I've overlooked. So, you know, go ahead, and if you've been waiting at all to support Vish and Creative Control, now is probably the best time to do it. I know as a public radio employee here in Kansas, listener-supported broadcasting, whether it's podcasts or radio itself, really isn't a thing of the past. It's actually very much a thing of both the present and the future. So, yay Vish, yay Creative Control.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Kai Brooks is a talented composer, sound engineer, musician, poet, singer, and producer based in Montreal, Quebec. Raised not far from Ottawa, Ontario, in Wakefield, Quebec, Brooks co-founded a key DIY space in Montreal called La Plante, and now operates a collectively run Montreal recording studio called Error 403. They have been a member of many bands, including the surreal jazz-oriented White Cube, an eight-person queer punk band called Femme Maggots, and noise rock explorers Lung Butter, among many others. Striking out on their own and under the name Kai, their stirring solo debut is called Power is the Pharmacy, which was released on May 12th, 2023, via Constellation Records. Kai and I caught up for a talk recently covering subjects like recording other bands and the aforementioned Error 403 space, the loss of their dear friend and bandmate, Joni Sadler, wanting to get out of Ottawa as a teenager, their early interest in classical music, bad behavior, and earnest academic pursuits, Western music cues and theatricality, loving pop music, obsessing over teeth, future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this donor-driven podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol. Thanks again for doing that. That means a lot. It really does. Plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee, respectively, in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is episode 777, lucky 777, I think, of Creative Control, featuring the thoughtful and compelling Kai, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Kai. How's it going?
Oh, very good. It's 10 p.m. in Montreal time.
Yes.
And very good. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you for making time. It is a little later than I usually talk to people as well, I must say, from my end of things. It's 10 o'clock Montreal time. It's around 10 after 8. Sorry, that sounded like I'm 10 minutes ahead of you. No, it's 10:10. And 8:10. So it's 8:10. It's late in the evening for both of us. Sorry about that. Anyway, but this was your preferred time, right? Later? Is that correct?
Yeah, no, it actually is good. I was in a recording session all day and we finished around 7 and I just needed to crash a little bit. So,
good.
So it's actually a really good time.
Now, can you tell us anything about the recording session? Was it related to your own work or something else?
I'm recording a project of a friend of mine, Jonathan Stern, and his band, who's called Volt. They're like a prog rock band. Hmm. And I work as a recording and mix engineer and do some live sound as well. So it's been 3 days of recording and we're just finished the bed tracks and stuff and getting started with overdubs tomorrow.
Oh.
But it's been really nice. And yeah.
That's great. Good. That's great. Yeah, I'd heard this about you, that you make records for people and not just your own, I suppose, and mix them and all those sorts of things. Do you have a preferred studio or do you have your own studio space in Montreal?
So the session I've been working on for the past couple of days is at my own studio, which is called Error 403. Hmm. And it's a space I share with Jessica Moss and Eve Parker Finley, for those on TikTok, and a couple of other, Robin from Big Brave, a variety of other folks working in mostly music related stuff in Montreal. And then I also record at Hotel to Tango, which is sort of the venerable Constellation Records associated and many other things associated studio. It's Howard Billerman and Redwan and Ephraim and Thierry. From Godspeed's place. So
yeah, that's a nice place. So I think the last time Jessica was on, she might have been at this space of yours because she was recording herself there, talking to me. She was in some sort of studio space, and I feel like she mentioned Big Brave. So yeah, it probably was. That's nice. There you go.
I'm sure it was. That's awesome.
So this is your studio. Like you started Error 403. That's like an internet error message, isn't that right?
Yeah. So the Jessica chose the name. It's like a collectively run space. So it's not like I started it, or it's like really all the people involved started it. And the name, we were kind of, we thought at first that it was the undefined error, error 4, which I think is error 401, actually. Oh. And then we discovered that it's the error, like domain not allowed error, which is like a little bit more harsh, I feel, but also it's kind of a cute name.
Okay. So. It's a yeah. technological name. Are there a lot of errors at your studio or no? It's error free, I'm guessing, mostly.
I would. It's both profoundly full of errors and completely pristine.
That's funny. No, that's good. All right. Well, I appreciate that. That's cool. So, and I'm pleased to speak with you about this. Is this your first solo record, or it's the first solo record you've made under the name Kai? Is that correct?
Yeah, it is. I put out a few things during the pandemic, just kind of like experiments and things that I was trying out. But it is my first. Like solo quote record. I mean, it's funny to talk about it as a solo record because there are so many people who played on it.
Yeah.
But it is kind of the first record that I've produced for myself, as myself, I guess.
Yeah.
So
that checks out. Now you've played in different bands, or at least one that I'm aware of, Lung Butter and some other things. Is that correct?
Yeah. I played in like a ton of random projects. I think Lung Butter is the one that I guess has the most like, I don't know, like, you know, we put out a vinyl and stuff like that. Yeah. But I've played in so many different projects over the last decade and a bit. And yeah, I do a lot of free improv and so like to do that with people who I have played with before. And that, of course, proliferates a million different ensembles, right? So yeah.
Okay. I want to, we're well into this. I want to extend my condolences to you on the passing of your colleague and mine, Joni Sadler. That happened in a couple of years ago during the pandemic. It was very shocking. So I just want to say I'm sorry.
Likewise.
You know, thank you. Yeah. You played in a band with Joni. You knew Joni a long time. Is that correct?
Yeah. I guess we were in Lung Butter for about a decade, actually. And I knew her for a little while before that. I met her when. A project that I was playing with Drum for Dudor, which is a guitar and voice noise duo I was in for a long time with Alex Pelchat, played a show at a sort of a DIY venue called La Brique. And the audience was one person, and that person was Joni. And I knew her for a long time, and she was really one of my closest friends. Did you know her through radio stuff?
I knew her mostly through university. Through PR kind of stuff. That's how we interacted the most. It's funny you asked this now, and I'm a bit on the spot. I feel like I knew her before she started working with Constellation as well. Is that possible? I think it is.
Oh, it's totally possible. She worked for Pop Montreal and also for CKUT and CJLO and I think the radio station at NBC. I forget which one it's called. So. She had a huge network of music folks, and I'm sure that you would have encountered her.
Yeah, I've been immersed in campus and community radio since, I don't know, at least 2005, if not before that, as a listener and occasional volunteer when I lived in Guelph, Ontario. So, the name popped up quite a bit, and we would collaborate, I suppose, on arranging things. When she got to Constellation. Yeah, so
totally. Yeah.
So sorry. I appreciate you explaining that. Are you actually from Montreal originally, or did you move there from somewhere?
I moved to Montreal from Wakefield, Quebec. Ah. I was in high school in Ottawa, and I lived in Wakefield. I was born in Oslo in Norway, but my parents moved to Wakefield when I was tiny, and they're both from New York City, actually. So kind of complicated trajectory, but I lived in Wakefield for my whole childhood, and moved to Montreal as soon as I could get the heck out of there. So
I see. That's a weird combination of cities you mentioned, because I've been to New York City, I've been to Oslo in Norway, and I've been to Wakefield. I played many shows. I played a good chunk of shows at the
Black Sheep Inn.
Wakefield.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So did you attend many events there?
Definitely. And I'm not sure exactly what the mechanics of it were, but I think my dad was at one point thinking about buying part of the Black Sheep as an organization. Oh. Maybe I actually shouldn't say this because I don't know all the details, but I know that he was sort of pals with the folks there, and there was something like that when I was really young, that I would go there. There were like all ages shows there sometimes in the afternoons, and I also would just like walk in and like be there a little bit when I was younger. And then yeah, when I started going to shows, I definitely went to shows at the Black Sheep.
It's still around, right?
I feel like I don't know exactly what's going on with it. I believe it's been closed for some time. Oh. But I don't want to share any information because I'm worried it'll just be spurious gossip.
Sorry.
But it is in fact still there. The sign is still there.
Okay.
I just haven't seen any shows advertised there in a long time. So I think the pandemic, like many places, I feel like maybe things slowed down there during the pandemic. So
I see. Okay. Yeah. There was a fellow there named Paul that I would deal with.
Yes, I know Paul.
Quite a bit.
Sure.
Yeah. And then the one time we stayed there, one of my bandmates came. We got to stay in the, it was a hotel, kind of a dare. That's the wrong word. I was going to say like a, it was like not a fully functioning hotel. Is that correct?
No.
Right. Right. So they would,
I feel like it was kind of like, it was like a place for musicians to stay, right?
Yeah, we would stay there, but my one friend came down after a night there and just white as a ghost, and claimed he'd seen ghosts and that the place was haunted.
Oh my God.
And then when we mentioned this to locals, they're like, yep, we think it is haunted. And I was like, what? And did you ever hear tell that it was haunted?
I never heard of any hauntings, but I was a very skeptical kid, so maybe no one would have told me.
It's
I don't know.
Just...
but I believe it for sure. That place has so much history.
Well, there's a slight possible, unless if the shows I played there were all ages, maybe we were in the same room at some point. Who knows?
It's very possible, yeah. For sure. Yeah. Like, I mean, I think a lot of artists pass through there, and a lot of artists move to Wakefield too. Like, I feel like, it's like a Anglophone sort of community that there are a lot of arts folks who have lived there for the years.
Yeah. And, you said you wanted to get the hell out of there as soon as you could. I think, is that what you said? Am I putting words in your mouth?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that was maybe a little bit more directed at Ottawa.
Oh, I see.
But definitely, I just feel like growing up there, like, I didn't learn to drive when I was a teenager, which sort of put a damper on a lot of things for me. So I would, like, you know, walk into town and go to the ski hill and, like, smoke weed and, like, do the things that teenagers do in a small town.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But, and, like, if I wanted to go to a show, like, you know, my dad would have to drive me. So,
yeah, I get it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And for those wondering, as I recall, because I used to do most of the driving, Wakefield is like 20 minutes from Ottawa, maybe?
Yeah, it depends on the traffic. I feel like in bad traffic, it can be like 40 minutes from where I went to high school, for example.
Okay.
But it's really like 20 minutes at a good time. Yeah.
Right. But a lot of our probably mutual friends and colleagues who live in that area, Ottawa, Wakefield, they do struggle to play music and stuff venue wise for other reasons. Is that a fair? I don't know. Everyone I know from Ottawa seemed a little upset that they were in Ottawa. Does that make any sense?
Well, that's definitely how I felt.
Yeah.
I also feel like I've had some really wonderful experiences playing in Ottawa. And, you know, Joni, for example, went to university there, and she moved back there during the pandemic.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I guess there are some like wonderful little communities of people doing cool stuff there, like Mark Molnar or like Lindsay Wellman, or Debaser is based out of there. And I don't know. I guess as I've gotten older, I feel more and more at ease with Ottawa and like kind of really like going there.
Yeah.
I'm going there at the end of the month to play at Club Saw with my group, and I'm actually very, very excited about it. Also, my friend Nick Schofield, who played synthesizer and gave me some mix input on my album, it works as the technical director of Club Saw in Ottawa.
Yeah.
So that's a wonderful thing. I think he lives in Gatineau.
Ah. And Club Saw is not, does it do other stuff besides being a club? I can't remember. Is it like a...
I think it's part of Arts Court. There's like a gallery. It's just like when I was a teenager, like there was like a gallery, and I think it was like an audiovisual gallery.
That's right.
Where they did like a lot of like, And I would like go to like hardcore and punk shows in the basement, which was Club Saw, and then go and like hang out on the roof of the Rideau Center.
Ah,
like, So it has like a huge history for me emotionally. I'm like, every time I play there, I'm like, this is so cool. I've made it.
I lived in Guelph, I worked and frequented an establishment called the Ed Video Media Arts Center. And in my capacity what was my title? I think I was the programming coordinator. I don't remember what my title was. Something like that. I would often, we would share traveling films or gallery exhibitions. And I feel like Saw was one of the partners we had. I might be getting this wrong, but does that make sense? Like they would do that kind of stuff, right?
It totally makes sense. Yeah. That checks out for sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
I should say also, like, I also think of Ottawa as a hotbed for great musicians and certainly it was a punk rock route. Sean Scallon and people would put on shows there, as I recall, and probably still do, I think.
Totally.
Yeah. So I'm not shitting on Ottawa. I think it's just, you could feel it. Like, I could feel it among the people we would play with. Like, there were just a little.
Everyone loves to shit on Ottawa.
Yeah.
And also, like, it is like, you know, it's a government town. Like, it closes at 9 p.m.
Yes, so. Exactly. That's true. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
So, did you start? It's again, given what you've just said, and I had a similar experience growing up in Cambridge, Ontario, where it just didn't feel like you could get something going. And I didn't feel like my friends and I didn't feel like we really had something going until we moved a half an hour away to Guelph, which was a university town with a lot more going on. Did you play music in your upbringing in Wakefield and Ottawa? Were you able to start playing or immerse yourself in music?
Well, I sang a lot. I did classical music lessons from when I was quite young. I did like classical voice with Janet Hamilton, who's an Ottawa voice teacher. She's really, really wonderful. And yeah, so I was around a ton of music when I was a kid, but I never started a band or anything like that. Like I feel like I definitely was just doing classical music stuff and things that were sort of like classical music associated with, like in terms of what I would make, like until after my undergrad, basically.
Yeah.
But I did go to see a lot of punk stuff and like I saw a wide variety of music in that town, but I didn't really make any music with other people in any way that like beyond like playing with my family, basically.
Oh, so, your family played.
Yeah. Well, my dad is a cellist and my stepmom's a saxophone player and my mother is like a huge music fan. And so like we're always around music, but but I never like started a high school band or anything cool like that. I was like way too dorky.
you were dorky, you say. Dorky, really?
Oh, for sure. For sure, for sure.
Well, what kind of stuff would a dorky person like you be into if it wasn't music? Like, what were you... I've had these conversations with some musicians of late, and a couple of them in recent months, both respectively said, well, I was kind of a jock until I got to high school. I was like a hard, but like these people sounded like they were like played soccer every single day of the year or basketball. And then something switched in them and they got into music and art and poetry and things like that. Were you into something like hardcore that wasn't music at that point in your life?
Yeah. I mean, like I was really into physics and math and I was like quite into studying, I would say. I was also like generally into causing trouble for my family. Like I was a fairly badly behaved kid. I was like scholarly, but like badly behaved. And then I did my undergrad and master's in mathematical biology. So I have like kind of a long story of doing things that aren't music stuff. So, which I really care about deeply and has been like very nurturing for me. I would say I was into like science and math stuff. I read a lot of poetry. I read a lot of like weird, you know, like the pretentious teenager literature. I read a lot.
I kind of want to know specifically. I want to know specifically what the pretentious teenager literature is, but I also am.
I'm sure you have your own pretentious teenager literature.
Absolutely,
like
I'm
everyone
sure.
Does.
Well, you know, if I think back on it, some of mine was from a bygone era. Kerouac, sort of getting into the beats and realizing that
Thomas Mann, or
stuff like that. Sure. I'm sorry. Did you say what was your major? Mathematical biology? Is that what you said?
Yeah, I did like I don't want to get too much down this road of stuff, but I did my undergrad in a double major in physiology and physics, and then like went on to do a master's in mathematical biology.
Mathematical biology? What is that? Are you counting the animals? What does that mean exactly?
It's basically like developing mathematical models to like investigate biological phenomena. So I was like working with differential delay equations to look at modeling the human immune system, which is really interesting. And I really, I don't know. I feel like I have taken this other left turn and have been working on music like since I finished my master's.
Yeah.
But I really loved working in that world. And I think it has given me a lot of interesting, weird, transferable skills.
100%. So, yeah. No, I could see that. I mean, I want to respect what you said about not wanting to go too far down that road. Thanks for fielding these questions. But I was going to ask, I mean, as a recording, would you categorize yourself as a recording engineer as well as a producer?
Yeah, I'm actually, I don't think I categorize myself as a producer so much as a recording engineer.
Okay, fair enough.
Pretty technical. So
fair enough. So the math and the science obviously comes into play in your work in that regard.
Totally.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like it gave me a great set of tools to think about signal processing and stuff like that. So yeah. And also like, I feel like I had, so this is funny, but I feel like I had some like really incredible mentorship like experiences at, like doing math bio stuff. Like and encountered some really excellent teachers, and that has been something that I've continued to appreciate and try to bring with me when I work on things, is like, you know, learning how to not be an asshole to people when you know something that they want to know. And I feel like that's very much something that I've like tried to bring into like, you know, working in the studio or like, you know, working with other musicians. And then also like the other attitude of like not getting scared when someone can do something that I have no possible capacity to do, or like, you know, that kind of thing. So I feel like that's maybe something that I really got from my experience working in that world, was just like having some really, really good teachers and appreciating how much that matters.
No, that's fascinating. So an increased knowledge base also gave you or instilled within you humility. Is that a way of putting it?
Yeah, I guess so. Or just like, I don't know, just appreciating how much it matters to have people around you who like care about like helping you learn how to do stuff, you know?
Yes, that's right. There's something when you, I think there's humility in helping people, I guess is maybe where I'm coming from. There's just like a,
Yeah,
you're not high and mighty. You're like, okay, I can help. I'm getting to that age, or I'm well past that age maybe, where I realize that, some of the things I do impact people on a, I wish I could do that level, or how do I get to do that level? And then what's the expression? You sort of pay it forward. All the mentorship I had and all the people that I look up to, they're in me still, and then I can pass it along to the next generation of journalists or broadcasters or musicians. Does that make sense?
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Exactly that. And then the other side of it, which is like, how do you learn to do something? You just practice and ask people about it.
Exactly. Yeah. It's not even that mystifying. It's just, I just did it and I just keep doing it. And then slowly but surely, I figure out how to get a little bit better at it. It sounds like that's been your experience as well.
Totally. Yeah. Doing a lot of things kind of badly and then like slowly feeling more confident about them. You know?
So based on the fact that you weren't, you describe yourself as a dork, and you got into the science and the math, I think, I guess, but you didn't take up, when did you actually take up your first instrument? Yeah, I feel like you alluded to this earlier, but I forget already. I'm sorry. When was that?
So I took violin lessons when I was a kid, and then I like did classical voice for a really long
time.
Like pre-opera stuff, basically. And then, after my undergrad, I was hanging out with these people who, you know, were like weird ass artsy fartsy types. And we like so I got involved with a group of friends who like started a DIY space and was very involved in that. And I think during the second year of this space being thing, like my friends Aaron and Micah and I started playing music together as like a noise trio, which was called White Cube. Mm-hmm. And we played a bunch of shows around Montreal. That would have been maybe 2010, 2011, maybe. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we were like a baritone saxophone, a bass, and I played synthesizer and sang. Or like, you know, we did like something that was like somewhere in between performance art and like, and music, I would say. We were like really into like, we were like, oh, we're the New Velvet Underground or something like that. And of course, I think we were like so weird. But so that was the first group that I started playing with. And then I joined like a queer punk band called the Femme Maggots, because I was working at this like cooperatively run cafe in Park X. And there were these like other people who worked at the cafe who were really cool. And then I like was hanging out after work one day at the cafe, and they were like jamming at this cafe. And one of them was like, oh, Kai, you should come sing. And then I sang with them, and we played for a bunch of years after that. And that was sort of my first experience touring and like playing with like a larger band. And yeah, it was just like a really good experience. But I've always sung. Like I don't really play instruments. I play the synthesizer quite poorly, and I play some noise guitar, but I'm not like really a instrumental musician, much as I wish I was.
I mean, it sounds like you are. Did you not compose the songs on, you have many collaborators, and I want to get to them, I believe, on this new album, Power is the Pharmacy, but you composed all the music. Is that correct?
Well, it kind of happened in a complicated way. Like, I basically, the process for that album, I read things on the synthesizer, and like, I'll sing melodies and then do that with people. So yeah, totally do compose music, but I'm not like a technically skilled performer, like of anything except for like, I think singing and production stuff basically. So yeah, like what that looked like is like, I messed around with the synthesizer and my voice and like record some stuff and then arrange it into a song of some kind. And then I'm like, hey friend, are you interested in trying to play on top of this thing I recorded? And then like friend ideally is like, sure. And then like plays some layers of improvisation on it. And then I like take that and then rearrange it all over the place and turn it into something that I feel matches. And then send it to the next friend. So that's what that process looked like for that album. It was very like, it's kind of a collage actually, more than anything.
Well, it does come across that way. The new record anyway, it does come across that way. It does feel collage-y and stimulating and surprising, I will say. I'm always like, where's this going to go? Given our discussion about your scholarly pursuits, do you have any music theory background or anything like that?
Oh, zero. My high school like voice teacher tried to teach me some music theory, and then she was like, this is just not worth it because this person is not interested. But I like, you know, I know it sounds good, and like I can like follow stuff if people explain it to me. Like I can do some like light sight reading, for example, but I don't really have like a strong music theory background or anything like that.
But was your high school voice teacher I mean, it sounds like they were correct at the time. You weren't interested. Are you interested now in learning that stuff?
I'm not sure. I feel like it can be useful for talking about things with people, and you know, working on other people's music, I've had to learn like somewhat trial by fire some important things in terms of like, you know, just having a communicative language that works with people. But I think beyond that, I'm not super interested. Like I kind of think of those things as mostly tools for talking about stuff with people. And probably someone who I'm close with will be like, oh, that's terrible. But that is I'm pretty pragmatic about it, honestly.
Well, it sounds like you have an ear for music. If someone's improvising over top of your synth and vocal parts, and then you're rearranging things that they've done, some might be like, I know myself, I'd probably screw up. Like someone might play something at a certain point, and I might not realize that by moving it, I've altered the key of the song, or you know what I'm saying? Like you, do you ever encounter that?
I don't really realize that stuff is the thing.
It doesn't matter to you.
I mean, if it sounds the way I want it to sound, then it's fine.
it probably means it is fine in a theoretical sense. You know what I mean? Like your ear is so seasoned as an engineer that, you know, it sounds like to me,
you might have more music theory than you maybe even realize. It may not be formalized, but it might be within you. You know what I mean?
I mean, I think it also just comes, like, I think everyone picks up, like, you know, norms of what music is, quote, quote, supposed to sound like, just like from listening to music. Like anyone who listens to, you know, like, for example, like Western classical music, like you just pick up certain things as the norms that they are. And, you know, like on some level, like some of that music theory stuff, like some of it is just like a sort of codification of norms.
That's true.
And like, that's kind of all, you know, and it, a lot of it is like, I don't know if you followed the Shankarian analysis scandal a couple of years ago. I forget the name of the prof. I think this really awesome prof wrote this paper called, I think it's White Western Music's White Racial Frame.
Yes, I do remember this.
I forget the guy's name. Yeah, and there was like a famous podcaster who posted about it. But I think one of the things that article was pointing to was the ways in which, like, you know, like norms around music and what music is good music and what music is like, does what and is for who and so on and so forth. Like they're kind of baked into the whole experience of listening to music and talking about music, you know?
Well, and I think those of us and people like you who have a penchant for noise experimentation are, you know, really flying in the face of some of that orthodoxy, right? I mean, it does seem like you're playing as and expressing yourself as freely as you possibly can. Is that a way of putting it?
I feel like that's very flattering. I feel like I'm trying to like get to a specific feeling like of something working right, I guess. I don't know if I'm like flying in the face of the establishment because I think I bring a lot of establishment with me, unfortunately. But there are frames that feels authentic.
Yeah,
you know?
Like I don't think you're playing completely. Sorry, I should clarify. And for those who want an example, I would listen to this record. Like you're clearly creating structures and arrangements. Yeah. It's not completely all over the place, but I think you're also within that structure or framework or arrangement. There's a lot going on. I mean, for someone who has, it seems to me, spent a lot of time vocalizing and also studying that, I mean, you tend to alternate between singing and sort of spoken word sing. How would you characterize speak singing, I guess. Is that a way of putting it?
Yeah. Sprechstimme. I don't know. I feel like, trying to figure out like how to communicate something. This is like kind of really hard to talk about. I feel like I don't know how to talk about why I do the thing the way I do it, you know?
Pretty instinctual?
Yeah. Well, it's just like, I mess around until something feels right, I guess.
Yeah.
Which is a big, like, sort of tacit underpinnings of, like, making music or something.
Well, there's one of the things I've observed about you and this record in particular is the kind of theatricality that creates. When you create dynamics within your own way of expressing yourself, whether you're going to be emoting impassioned, like with like a borderline screaming, let's say it that way, and then you're going to be speaking and then you're going to be singing, it creates a drama, like a suspenseful what's going to happen kind of thing. And so I think within everything you're doing and with the music as well, being in a conventional sense somewhat off kilter, again, is theatricality important to you, or am I on the right track with, or sorry,
oh, totally.
Is that a way of describing your work?
Yeah, that's awesome. I love that's a thing that you're thinking about. I definitely feel like it's like very heightened, I guess, is like my feeling about it. I'm trying to make it like as emotionally intense as I can.
Yeah.
I would say.
Mission accomplished.
And sometimes that involves cool. That's awesome. And then sometimes that involves like being very quiet, and then sometimes that involves like, you know, being very intense.
Do you have a sense of, like, we've kind of talked about where your background in terms of how you got into music, but in terms of performers that you admire or looked up to when you were younger, because classical music, for some people it's a pretty Western classical music is pretty staid, but it's also quite dramatic, I think. When you think about it, like if you actually, it's moving constantly and it has the same sort of quiet, loud dynamics, or it can, depending on what you're listening to. Do you have a sense of where your penchant and affinity for theatrical music and theatrical performance maybe comes from?
Well, okay, that's a really, okay, because my first impulse was to be like, oh, I love Bjork, you know, I'm trying to think of like the musical, like as a singer, like it, a lot of it's just like pop music where like Bjork, or like I've been listening to like a Justin Timberlake a lot, like with this record, or like I really love Radiohead when I was a teenager because I'm a dorky teenager, or like also just like punk music across the board, like some of those projects, like the really raw thing that they bring has meant so much, like, or has like really hit me really hard. I think Magic Markers was like a crazy one for me. Like I started listening to them like after the first Lung Butter record, not the one that came out on Constellation, but a tape. We put out a bunch of cassettes. And our first album that we put out, like that summer, we like toured a little bit in the States, and like I heard Magic Markers and I was like, that's crazy. That's so cool. So some things like that. Yeah, I'm trying to like link it to being a teenager, but I'm like, I feel like as a teenager, I was really into like, I like listened to some classical music and I listened to some like weird ass shit that I found at the library. And like, also like a lot of that like British revival stuff that was happening when I was like, what, like 14 or 15, like Interpol also.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Amy Winehouse, like this kind of world of things was what I was listening to.
So some pretty like prominent pop artists as well.
Yeah, I love pop music, and like I feel like I've gotten like a ton of energy from pop music.
Yeah. But is that a source of drama, theatricality? I mean, it can be for sure.
I think so. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, totally. Yeah, it's all super heightened. It's like about a persona and like someone really like being super intentional about expressing their emotions in a very particular way. Mm-hmm. And like, I really like that, I guess.
I feel like
I don't know. Does that make any sense?
No, it does. It does make complete sense, because I think you and I anyway, are coming from the same place. There's there's drama and intensity in a pop or rock performance. I mean, I'm sure seeing someone like Amy Winehouse, I never got to see Amy Winehouse, but I did get to see people like Sharon Jones. And that kind of sense of fun, but also a sense of like the drama of the spectacle of it was like moving in itself. Like you couldn't take your eyes off her. She was a compelling performer. I haven't had the opportunity to see you live. Like, do you bring this to the stage? This level of, because what you said earlier stuck out for me. You were kind of said you were chasing a feeling with this music more than maybe getting everything technically, conventionally correct. Mm-hmm. Does that speak to your actions as a performer and your approach to performing and singing and all those sorts of things?
Chasing a feeling for sure. Give my left foot to bring any like an ounce of what some of these performers that we've listed bring to the stage, you know, that's like what I really, one of the many things I really, really admire in other performers is like when they can bring that to an audience. It is certainly what I'm trying to do. I don't know how effective I am at it, but it's definitely like I'm way less interested in technical perfection than I am in just like, oh, how can I communicate clearly?
No, that makes sense to me. I mean, I can't, when did you actually start working on this record? Like what, sorry, I assume it was during the pandemic, or when did you start?
Yeah, I started working on it about 6 months into the pandemic.
Okay.
And I'd released a couple of things. Like I played like a Drone Day performance, and my friend Matt Redding and I had done some like collaborative synthesizer and voice stuff, which we called Vexing, which we do have a short album out, which I'm actually like very proud of. Mm-hmm. And it's like experimental electronic music.
Yeah.
So I was like messing around with synthesizers about 6 months into the pandemic. And then the CERB happened. And I had more money than I had ever had in my life and was able to buy two synthesizers that I'd been wanting and a microphone that I'd wanted. And sort of that's how it started, is I was like locked up at home and wanting to work on music. And I did this. Okay. Have you heard of The Artist's Way? Have you heard about this book?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. The Artist's Way is this like super cheesy 80s self-help book that's like aimed at creatives and is like meant to be like a like get yourself artistically unstuck using this 12-step program that is like loosely based on AA.
Oh.
And I did this program. It's like it's a book and you like basically journal every day and then you do some fun stuff and like try to take your art seriously and you do some like, you know, self-therapy stuff. And it was so incredibly effective for me. Like I did this program and I was like taking some time off of, like, I'm doing a degree right now and I was taking some time off of that and was just like able to like only do art for a little while, which was so amazing.
Yeah, nice. Yeah.
And then I like recorded like a lot of the record, like within like a 3-month period maybe. And then things got really slow and I just kept on like it was like sort of this like frenzy of a couple of months of like doing stuff. And then like 3 years or like 2 years, I guess, of like changing and editing and re-recording. And then like, I like sent it to Constellation and they weren't sure if they wanted to put it out. And then they were like, okay, like we'll give it some more time. And I like redid a ton of stuff like after that. Cause I was like, rah! So yeah, it was sort of like a very fast process followed by a very slow process.
I see. Okay. So did this time period serve as the primary source of your lyricism on this record?
I wrote a bunch of the poetry that appears on the record like way before I even started working on the record.
Mm.
And then a couple of the songs I recorded, like I improvised just like one take, it's weird, but it's like the week after Joni passed away, because I had some time booked at Hotel Tatango to work on my record.
Mm.
And then like I didn't want to cancel the time because I was like, I feel crazy. I don't know what to do. I guess it was 3 weeks actually after. It wasn't a week after.
Right.
But I was like, oh, I'm losing my mind. What do I do with myself? And so I like kept the date and then like re-recorded some things kind of all at once and changed a bunch of lyrics on a couple of songs at that point.
Okay. So
from what they had originally solidified into, I guess.
So I know from what I understand, a piece like All the Sad and Loving People was inspired by Joni's passing. Is that correct?
Yeah, that was the only one that I wrote the whole thing after she passed away.
Yeah.
And it was actually something that I wrote for like a compilation album that her friends made for each other.
Oh, okay.
And then I recorded one version of it for that. And then later I was like, oh, I would really like to put this on the album.
Mm.
And so I made a bunch of changes and put it on the album.
Right.
Yeah.
So the revisions, so some of this, you say some of the poetry was written before the pandemic started. Did anything about our collective consciousness, our collective experience in the last 3 years or so, did that infuse any of these pieces? Like, did it end up sort of influencing what you wanted to talk about or write about?
Yeah, totally. Okay, so the original title for the album was Capitalism, Dreams, and the Fear of Loss, which was a very pretentious title, even less pretentious than the current title. But I think a lot of what I was feeling and trying to record, yeah, it was around this feeling of like being in your early 30s and just having no, well, I don't know if the age part is important, but like, you know, being like, okay, like life is supposed to be settling in some way in theory, maybe.
Yeah.
And now everything is so deeply uncertain.
Yeah.
And I am so alone and everyone is so alone and governments are not doing shit to help with this stuff, and you know, like give or take, and like, yeah, so I think I was experiencing the same kinds of feelings that many other people were experiencing at that time, of like profound uncertainty.
Yeah.
And that's definitely what I was writing about, or like what I was trying to convey, even if I'd written the words beforehand.
Well, one of the songs here that I think of and I'm confused about, but I also think I get it, is Teeth or rather powers the pharmacy. Teeth, is that what it's called? I think that's right.
Yeah, it was originally called Teeth, and and then took on the name of the album as well, because I felt it was the right name for it.
But there's some healthcare stuff going on in there. I couldn't figure that one out on some level. It's pretty visceral about our teeth. Is that right?
Okay, that song is so funny. Like, okay, on one level, it's about like being afraid of losing your teeth, you know, sure. on a very stupid level. Yeah. Like, I have very, very bad teeth and I have a lot of anxiety about it. And I think a lot of people have that experience. On another level, what the song is sort of really about is like the possibility of repair. It's like an anti-entropy question. Mm. It's like, is it possible to repair things that have been fully broken? And can you unchew the world in some way? Like, so like the way that I was thinking about that poem is like as a conversation between two people, and that's the two voices that move back and forth in the stereo field if you listen to it. And it's like two people sort of talking in this like confused way about like whether it's possible to rewind, whether it's possible to repair, like this thing of like, you know, for example, like sometimes in a relationship or a friendship, like you say things that you can never unsay, right?
Yeah.
And that damage the relationship or something like that. And you can, you know, you can certainly heal from those things and like rebuild trust and care. But there's always a sense in which like the things that have happened, you know? Mm. And that's what that song is about.
I appreciate that explanation because I found it jarring, but I never thought of it. I don't know. I have a negative bias. So I only thought, something's wrong here, but you're saying if there's a hopefulness to that song, and perhaps would you say there's hope running throughout this record on some level?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, it's like I think there's a lot of sadness in it and a lot of like resignation, and a lot of it is about being afraid of losing the things that you care about and the people that you care about. And that's like, you know, kind of the central theme of the album. But I think that there's also like, I like to think, I hope that there is a sense of like liveliness in it.
Yeah, no, there is. Yeah.
You know?
The spirit of it is not a downcast one, but it's...
Honestly, it's a kind of pissed off album.
Yes, exactly. And that suggests that change is desired. And when you're pushing for change, that is a hopeful gesture. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's definitely... I'm really glad that's what you're getting from it, because that's...
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm so obscure. It's really hard. It's hard to know how to communicate about, writing music and stuff. But that's totally what I'm trying to go for. So I'm really glad that's what you got.
No, I got it. I mean, for those who come upon the record, the album cover in itself is striking and maybe a bit daunting. Kai, can you describe the album cover?
The album cover is a picture that was taken by my friend Mathieu Ball, who plays guitar on the album and is also the guitar player for Big Brave. And it's a photograph of a chair burning in the snow. And the photograph was part of a two-part series that I think he did for his maybe a final project, but has also been released as part of like an art book put out by The Garotte, which is Matt's label in the States, which is a really wonderful little experimental label. The nicest folks, I think they're amazing. All the music that they put out is great.
Nice.
And they put out art books as well. And so that's what the image is. And it kind of refers to like during the pandemic, some friends, Mathieu and Jessica included, and Robin. Anyway, some of my closest friends we had some bonfires during the pandemic. And it was like our one weekly thing we would do together. It was like the one social thing is have this bonfire in the snow. So that image really resonated with me on that level, like in a very literal sense. And then also on this level of like, oh, the chair you're sitting on is on fire. It's like the little dog in the house being like, this is okay.
This is fine. This is fine.
Yeah, this is fine.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. So
I see. Okay. It sort of works on a couple of different metaphorical levels, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah. So like when I saw that image, I was like, oh my God, Mathieu, can I please use this as the cover image? And he was very kind and let me do that.
Well, it is very striking. And I appreciate you explaining that to me too, because where I was coming from is I do hear the hope and I do hear the pissed offness, And as we've established, those two things aren't necessarily mutually exclusive. But then you got a picture of a chair on fire, and it's a little scary. That's all I was getting at. So I'm scared. I'm motivated. I'm scared. I'm confused. It's a very thrilling record in this regard. It runs the emotion. It's an emotional roller coaster. You know what I'm saying?
This is like the deepest flattery. I'm so stoked that that's what you're feeling from it.
Well,
so.
it is my pleasure. Is there anything more you want to say in an overarching sense about this record for people who are encountering it? I know we haven't touched upon all of it, but just curious. I want to give you some time. Is there anything more you want to say?
I feel like those are some of the really big things about the record that you got to. I think that the other big thing about it is like it's a hugely collaborative record, and like the artists and friends who played on it are all amazing. And like, you know, as I said, I'm not a technically skilled instrumentalist. Yeah. And there's some incredibly technically, emotionally, musically skilled instrumentalists on that album. And I'm so grateful for that. So it's like really hard to think, like it's a really long list of people. I think there's like 11 people who played on it.
Yeah, for sure.
But like, yeah, just wanting to like deeply express my appreciation for all of those folks. Like Farley, the drummer, plays in a band called Fee Faw Fum, who are currently putting out like one of the most fun like proggy pop punk records I've heard in a really long time. Mm. And Mathieu plays in Big Brave. The bass player Josh plays in a band called Gong Gong Gong, who are mostly based in Beijing but are like really awesome, like crowdy noise rock. James, the saxophone player, is one of my oldest, dearest friends, and we've played together for forever and ever. And he has a project called Skin Tone, which I just recorded a record, which will be coming out at some point soon. And anyway, that's just like four, like that's like five of the people, but like there's like 11 people on this album, plus my mastering engineer, who is like the coolest. And everyone, like I could talk for like 5 minutes about each of them, but I probably will do a bad job of it. So.
Well, we'll ask people to check out the liner notes, I guess. And
yeah, check out the liner notes. Like everyone who played on that album is like super sick, and like I'm deeply, deeply grateful to have played with them.
Oh, nice.
So
that's lovely.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's a testament to you. You brought these people together. They wanted to work with you. I think that's a...
Oh, I'm very lucky. Yeah. I'm very, very lucky. So.
No, I appreciate that. Are you working on something new in your own pursuits? I know you work with others, and it sounds like you were working with someone today on something of theirs, but what's next for you in particular, Kai?
Well, I'm maybe halfway through recording my next album right now.
Oh, cool.
That's been sort of like, again, fits and starts. Like I had a recording session 2 weeks ago at Hotel Tatango with a group of collaborators, and I have all the music written and most of the instrumental and synthesizer stuff recorded. I think there will be a couple more passes of work with people. But yeah, so I'm working on another album. I am not going to hurry anyone to put it out. I'm just going to take my time with it because I am... Anyway, I have to respect the album cycle, you know?
Yeah,
so,
for sure.
But I'm very much working on the next thing and feeling super... I don't know. Like I went through like a bit of a fallow period, like after I finished this record, like especially like waiting to know whether I would be putting it out on my own or with my friends at Constellation or with another label or anything. Anyway, so I was like kind of feeling I wasn't very creative for a while there. And then I had this like crazy brain zap like last fall where I just wrote like a ton of music and I'm sort of working on that.
That's great. I think you're not the only one coming out of some sort of intellectual and emotional and spiritual hibernation. So, but it sounds like you're always very
totally.
Busy. So I'm pleased to hear that. That's great. If people want to learn more about you specifically or, you know, engage with you on whatever platforms, is there somewhere people can go?
I have an Instagram, which is Alt Nouveau Metal Kai on Instagram. And I have a website, which is not a great place to engage with me, but it is there. I would say Instagram is probably the best move.
Okay. All right.
I message people back. If they message me on Instagram, I'll message them. That's all.
Okay. I'll link to your Instagram. How about that? And people can
Sounds
click
great.
On that if they want to learn more. If we can go out on a song... From Power is the Pharmacy, I wonder if you could pick one for us and explain why it came to mind.
I would say definitely All the Sad and Loving People, but maybe the radio edit because the field recording is kind of long.
I don't. It's a podcast. We don't. Are you worried that people are? It's fine. We've been.
Oh,
I think.
Okay.
I want to play like the is a 6 minute version. Yeah. The regular version?
Yeah, there's a really the whatever the one that's not the radio edit on Bandcamp is the one to go out on, I think.
Okay.
Because it's really my favorite one. It's my favorite song on the album, and
we talked about it a little bit.
Yeah.
So it's relevant. It's exactly. Germane. It's germane
exactly.
to the conversation.
Indeed.
Okay, this is All the Sad and Loving People from the brilliant new album Power is the Pharmacy. By Kai. Kai, thank you so much for being on this show. I hope you enjoyed yourself and that we speak again, and best of luck in the future.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a real pleasure. Yeah, great.
We'll be right back.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
It's very nice to encounter Kai. I don't think I've ever encountered Kai. Kai, thank you so much for being on this, the 777th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network. And for everyone who is unfamiliar, this show is available wherever you get your podcast, pretty much, except for the one place. If you can't find an episode that you're looking for, or if you want to learn more about me, you can sign up for my monthly newsletter, which I'm woefully behind on. I'm like 6 months, but nah, I can't be that many. I'm behind. It's been busy. Anyway, if you want to learn more about me and sign up for the newsletter, I'll get to it. Please visit vishkana.com. You can like Creative Control on the Facebook. You can also follow the show currently on the Twitter at Vish Creative, or you can follow me directly on the Twitter and on the Instagram at Vish Khanna. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to this donor-driven podcast. That's where most of the good, clean money comes from. People like you who like the show, who like to see it exist, and so you fork up some hard-earned money, and you summon your generosity. Now, whatever you can donate is amazing per month. It's a, like I say, it's a monthly flexible donation. You can start at one level and you can go up or down. It really don't matter. Now, $6 American or more grants you access to exclusive content. And if you're interested in receiving a Creative Control t-shirt, just message me on Patreon and I'll get you one while supplies last. Thanks again for supporting the show at patreon.com/creativecontrol. I also want to thank Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario, for their in-kind support for this show. I want to thank my friend Jim Guthrie, who loves a good donut. I know that for a fact. If anyone likes a good donut and a cup of coffee, it's that Jim Guthrie. You can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you so much for listening to this episode with Kai. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you're familiar with Kai, I hope you still learned something. If you've never heard of Kai at all, well, here we go. Now you know a bit about Kai, and we'll check out their wonderful music via Constellation Records currently, and follow them on Instagram. I've linked all that stuff. Otherwise, thank you. I hope you're well and that you will subscribe to this podcast or follow it if you don't do that already, and tell your friends to do the same. And maybe that'll help spread the word about this show that I've been working on. It's been 10 years of work and it's fun, but I'm, still kicking here doing that stuff. Anyway, enough about me. I'm a little tired. I'm going to go to sleep. I'll talk to you soon. Bye for now. Oh, see, that's the sleep talking. I would never do a voice like that normally.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.